Hi, welcome to episode 7 of the Woke-ish podcast. This is Ebony.
And this is Zalma.
And this week we will be discussing the 2-part documentary Leaving Neverland. But before we get there, we will start with our shout-out segment.
Yes. So our first shout-out goes to the whole country of Rwanda, who is now using drones to deliver blood supplies to hospitals. So apparently the typical way to deliver blood is by road, which often takes a really long time. However, these drones are launched into the air, and once they get to their destination, they descend to the height of 30 feet, where they then drop the package of blood, which floats gently to the ground with the help of a paper parachute. Wow. So I just think that's really awesome to be able to use drones. I mean, we use drones in so many, like, evil ways in terms of, like, surveillance or military use. So I just thought it was a nice to think about drones being used in a positive way, especially to solve problems. So shout out to Rwanda for doing that, because I'm sure it's helping a lot of lives by cutting the time that it takes for the blood to transport to the people that need it. And then our second shout out goes to Senator Bernie Sanders, whose campaign says that now every one of his teams has women and predominantly women of color in leadership positions. I think he also is the first campaign who has every person working for him unionized. Mm-hmm. So shout out to his campaign. He definitely, I think, is a huge proponent of the things that is reflected by the people that he hires. So he, you know, he talks the talks about, you know, diversity and needing women and women of color to be in positions of power. So I thought it was really cool that his campaign, he actually puts that in action. So shout out to Senator Bernie Sanders. Yeah. And, you know, hopefully other people will look at this and kind of be inspired, or just kind of, you know, at least for these women, the women of color who are in leadership positions, that they'll be able to influence his campaign in a more positive way. Even if I don't know if he's gonna, you know, make it to the nomination, I just think it's cool that we're able to have the representation.
And then our final shout out goes to Rotten Tomatoes. And so Rotten Tomatoes is a sort of movie review website or entity, and so if you see, like, ratings for movies, typically they come from Rotten Tomatoes. And so they recently changed their audience rating system after Captain Marvel was attacked by trolls. So they made major changes to their rating system protocol. Ultimately, I guess the biggest change is that fans will no longer be allowed to post reviews or leave comments before films and TV shows are released due to the recent trolling attacks on some movies, including Black Panther and Captain Marvel. So Captain Marvel received a lot of negative ratings, but they're calling these trolled attacks because they got a lot of these negative ratings before the movie had even come out. And so you may have also heard that some of the criticism of the movie was kind of based in sexism. After having seen the movie, I actually do think that that could potentially be the case, because there were so many, like, blatant attempts on the part of the movie to make this about women's empowerment. Mm-hmm. Like, even the way that the Captain Marvel's, like, certain movements that she does, or certain behaviors, or certain scenes, you can tell that there's kind of a, like, women's empowerment, maybe feminist sort of undertone to them, and that was not received very well. So yeah, shout out to all of, you know, these folks, Rwanda, Bernie Sanders, and Rotten Tomatoes. And now we will transition into our In the Know segment. Extra, extra, read all about it. So now for our In the Know segment.
Yes, so our first In the Know topic is about Twitter. So apparently Twitter is being sued for $250 million by Representative Devin Nunes. He's seeking $25 million in damages, accusing the social media website of shadow banning conservatives. So shadow banning, I had to look it up, is the practice of limiting a user's reach by making their posts visible only to themselves. It's a common conspiracy theory among conservatives that social media companies like Twitter, it's shadow ban right-wing votes. So they say that this is, in a way, a tool to censor them. This theory gained momentum last summer when it appeared that some accounts, including those of certain Republican politicians and white supremacists, weren't being automatically suggested when people searched their names. Twitter resolved the search issue and later published a blog in the hope of setting the record straight on shadow banning. So apparently this representative wants Twitter to pay him the $250 million for failing to protect him from online harassment in addition to saying that they censor him. So in response, Twitter stated that they do not shadow ban. You are always able to see tweets from accounts that you follow, although they do acknowledge that you may have to do more work to find them, like go directly to their profile, and that they certainly don't shadow ban based on political viewpoints or ideology. So this is something that I hear by a lot of, I guess, right-wing people, that Twitter is too liberal, and that Twitter, like, protects some viewpoint, but, like, censors others. And one of the ways, and one of the examples of this, is with Twitter can, like, I guess, remove you from the website if you misgender someone. So if someone's trans and you call them by the gender identity that they don't align with, they can remove you from their platform. And a lot of right-wing conservatives say, well, this is, you know, kind of, I don't see them in the identity that they're aligning themselves with. I see them in whatever identity they were born with. So, and you removing me from this platform because I don't agree with this, I guess they think it's an ideology. They're like, because I'm not liberal enough and I don't engage in this, it's even hard for me to even kind of rationalize in their minds why they can't just, you know, refer to someone in the gender identity that they choose. But I think for some people, for some conservatives who refuse to do that, they feel like it's an infringement of their rights to be removed from this platform for misgendering someone. And so I actually listened to the CEO talk about this, and he was just saying that, you know, they're at this kind of boundary where they're trying to be respectful of everyone, but also trying not to infringe on people's rights. And so this is the largest suit against Twitter, $250 million. And this shadow banning thing is something that I hear repeatedly by a lot of people. A lot of people on Fox, Sean Hannity. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump, you know, this is something Trump believed. So Twitter's responding by saying that they absolutely do not do this, and that they don't think that, you know, much is going to come from this lawsuit. But we'll definitely, you know, keep an eye on it, because one of the tricky things about Twitter is, although it's a public platform, it's a private company. So, and it's kind of like, do they have the right to keep people from access to posting tweets? Do they have the right to clean out white supremacist accounts, you know, hate speech, if it's a public platform as a private company? And so I think that, you know, this suit is going to test that. So just wanted to bring that to the forefront, because Twitter is, you know, one of the ways that the president kind of uses to be able to just give us his daily thoughts. And so I think that, you know, when it comes to Twitter and what Twitter can and can't do, I think it's important, because that's one of the main platforms that the president and his followers use. And I have seen a lot of hate and a lot of people having to leave Twitter because they received a lot of hate tweets or bullying or threats. And so, you know, this is just the first official one where someone is saying that they're being harassed on Twitter and they want, like, damages.
But how can they, like, what evidence do they have that this is happening?
That their people are...
The shadow banning thing. Like, what's the evidence of that?
Well, the main thing is tweets that pop up are left-leaning. And so Twitter's response was like, well, it's like a news feed. Like, you can customize it. So based on the kind of accounts you follow and stuff, like, that should show up on your newsfeed. So people are like, well, I follow a lot of right-wing stuff, but they're not showing up on my newsfeed. It's because it's so much easier to find more liberal accounts than it is right-wing accounts. So that's one of the evidence that they cite. And the second one is the fact that they say when you search someone, it doesn't pop up. Like in Facebook, you have the option of not being able to be searched. So you can type in your name and you still won't pop up. So they say that they claim that that's what's happening on Twitter.
Okay.
And Twitter responded and said that that's not true.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think the second part of his lawsuit is that he is getting a lot of online harassment, which is insane because there have been like those teenagers from the shootings have gotten like death threats from people saying like they should have died, you know, calling them derogatory homophobic slurs, and they don't sue Twitter.
I think it you know, it's interesting where people decide to point the finger, like where they put the blame. I mean, it, because there, I haven't heard anyone, like when you ask like, oh, okay, well, or when you push back on conservatives or some, you know, some extremists, and you accuse, you say that their the language that they're using is hateful, I haven't heard a very strong argument against that. You know, and so let's, it's like, why not focus on what we see as the cause? Like, if there's hate speech, you know, because, I mean, one of the things that's interesting is, like, the internet, in terms of, it, like, the this whether or not it's recognized as, like, a public space, you know, as, like, the same way that maybe a grocery store would be or, like, a park, you know? Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about free speech, where does the internet or Twitter, or these platforms fall? Like, is this considered a space that's supposed to be safe, or is this the equivalent of like just walking down the street and yelling out something hateful at somebody? You know, like hateful tweets. And so if we are seeing, if we're seeing this as a space that's like supposed to be safe for everybody and it's supposed to be free of hate speech, then I would say that Twitter is Twitter's decision, or if, I mean, if they are shadow banning, then it's like, are they wrong for that? If we aren't supposed to allow hate speech in this space. But if this is a space where hate speech is welcome, then they are wrong. I think that we just have to, we got to figure out. And I was thinking about this because there was a conversation recently with the Oscars and Steven Spielberg, and how he was saying that he didn't feel that that like Netflix and Hulu and stuff in their movies should be included and, you know, be, like, you know, set beside movies that are in theaters.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, because you're saying that this is, like, a new, this is, like, a new lane. Like, we, the rules for winning an Oscar weren't created with, you know, Netflix movies in mind. Because it's kind of, like, you know, it's a little bit different. Like, getting someone out of their house and out of their comfort zone to the movie theater to watch your movies is a little bit different than them just being able to turn on, this is, like, kind of his argument.
Yeah.
Him just, them just being able to turn on Netflix at their home or on their laptop or whatever. And so his argument was that we need to create a new lane, like, a new category for these types of movies to adjust to, like, the changes. And I think the same thing about, you know, like, social media. Like, we need to create new rules or new laws to govern them, because it isn't the same as interacting with someone in person. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know. I think, I think that there's a lot that has to be figured out, because we just let social media pop up and it's like, oh, you know, kids are being bullied on social media. Kids are being threatened on social media. Kids are committing suicide because of, you know, hate speech on social media, but we have no way of policing it, really. Okay, and so now moving on to our...
Our second in the know is a story that, you know, by now you've probably heard a lot about, and that's the terrorist attack in New Zealand. So 50 people... It's an attack where 50 people were killed and 50 others wounded. And so there's different numbers, and that's because they keep finding new victims, or because victims were missing, or, you know, victims who were in critical care died. So as of now, it's 50 people killed, 50 others wounded at a, on a terror attack on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. So a gunman targeted two mosques in central Christchurch at lunchtime on Friday, which is the busiest day for many mosques around the world for Friday prayer. Graphic video, which streamed live on social media on Facebook Live for about 17 minutes, shows a portion of the attack. He, like, mounted a camera on his head so you can get, like, the first-person shooter view. In it, the man is seen driving through the streets of Christchurch before arriving at the mosque and eventually opening fire. As a result, social media sites such as Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter struggled to halt the spread of the footage, raising new questions about the company's ability to manage harmful content on their platforms. I read an article saying that, you know, a user flagged this video to Facebook, But by the time they scrubbed it, like, it had been viewed at least 2,000 times. Mm-hmm. And that the difficult part is, even though they can take it down, someone can, like, save it.
Yeah.
And then it stays on. It's hard to scrub something off the internet, even if you take it off of your website. And so the shooter's name, so Brenton Tarrant, 28, who's a white man, is charged with the attack and is also charged with allegedly posting an 87-page manifesto prior to the attack filled with anti-immigration and anti-Muslim sentiment. At his court appearance, he flashed a white power sign. So that coupled with what it says in the manifesto, you know, saying things, naming Trump as a cultural hero, saying a lot of anti-immigration and anti-Muslim things, that the motive for this was hate and white supremacy.
Yeah, and then our third in the know topic is, so Just Hilarious, apparently folks are saying that, which I don't even know what canceled means at this point. Like, I'm kind of unclear about, you know, does cancel mean that, like, we're unfollowing her on social media, or, like, you know, whoever's being canceled, do they get unfollowed on social media? Does that mean no longer supporting the, you know, if they have shows or things that require us to buy tickets, like, are we no longer supporting them that way? I don't know. I'm not really sure, clear on what canceled actually means. But Just Hilarious is a comedian, and apparently she has been canceled after Islamophobic posts on social media. So the Baltimore social media personality posted about a group of Sikhs who were boarding her plane. And in this video, she essentially stated that she felt threatened. I think that when they got on the plane, she said something like, oh no, like, where are you going, or something like that. And now, after kind of being dragged on social media, she's apologizing. So she last week posted a series of now deleted clips where she claimed that her life was in danger after four Sikh men in turbans were on the same plane as she was. Folks on Twitter dragged her for her insensitive comments, and quite a few Sikhs reached out to her, she said, to educate her on who they were and the fact that they were different from Muslim, that they were different from Muslims, and that they actually were not Muslim at all. And this was, I think, particularly a big deal in the wake of the New Zealand mosque shooting that Zelma just talked about, that occurred last week as well. And at the time when people were dragging her, or initially, she kind of, you know, was defensive and was like, you know, well, fuck y'all, and along with a few other things that she said. But after a solid few days of being roasted, she offered a tearful apology in the form of a video, and said that she'll be donating $15,000 to the victims of the New Zealand shooting. And this is being considered a step in the right direction. But yeah, I mean, this is, I want to say, I think that she also, people were also really upset at her a few weeks ago for something else kind of insensitive that she'd said. And, you know, in her video, her apology video, she was like, well, I'm young, like, I didn't know, and all of this stuff, which I think, if for someone who works on social media, like, whose job literally requires her to be on social media all the time, it just is hard for me to believe that she had no idea that this was happening. Maybe she didn't know who Sikhs were, fine, but to kind of feed into Islamophobia at this particular time was just, I mean, was pretty ridiculous. So I mean, I'm not giving her a lot of my money as it is, or any of my money as it is, so I don't know that, like, what me canceling her would require. But yeah. And then in other news, Gucci, who also has received a lot of slander over the last month, has revealed a diversity initiative after the backlash they received for their quote-unquote blackface sweater. They've created a new program to support diversity and inclusion in fashion. This program is called the Gucci Changemakers Program, which the brand says was launched internally in 2018 and will offer a $5 million fund to aid communities of color, as well as $1.5 million in scholarships in North America. Selected college students will receive $20,000 over the course of 4 years. Gucci Changemakers also includes an external counsel to hold itself accountable and help select nonprofit partners in the U.S. One of the members of the North American Council is rapper Will.i.am. Also, all 18,000 Gucci employees will be receiving 4 paid days off to volunteer locally in 4 main areas. Those areas include equality, support for refugees and the homeless, protection of the environment, and education. And so, yeah, I'm excited about that. And I'm excited that they're, you know, responding to their backlash by actually, you know, changing their behavior and sort of the structure of their company, because a lot of the backlash was kind of, you know, couched under the recommendation, or couched within the recommendation, that they have people of color on these councils and things like that, and suggesting that if they did have these people as part of their company, they wouldn't be making these mistakes because they would get checked before it happens. So yeah, I mean, good things are being planned. Hopefully they follow through with them.
Yeah, and even if, you know, I think some of the criticism is like, this is just for show. But even if it's just for show, it's like, I think, a step towards the right direction, instead of just saying, our bad, you know, we didn't realize it was insensitive. It's a different thing to say, well, we realize that, and one of the solutions could be more representation. And so I hope that, I mean, I hope that people actually do go on their days off to volunteer to these places. But, you know, good for Gucci. I mean, I don't know if they, like, actually care about, you know, the repercussions of their, like, because, I mean, there's so many people that I heard who were like, I didn't see anything wrong with it. People are reading too much into it. So it's nice to see that they are able to at least, like, own up a little bit to it. And hopefully, you know, we've seen this with other labels that have made it culturally insensitive. With fashion, too, just kind of, like, references and stuff. That this is a good example of ways that you can kind of use your money to better ways than just to say, oh, well, we're just going to pull this and not make money off of this particular sweater, but putting it in different areas where they can actually improve. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of these college students who will receive the scholarships will really, really appreciate that. So, yeah. You know, good turn for such a, like, a messy situation. So, you know, I guess good for Gucci, but yeah, I know, but, you know, definitely they did more than I thought that they would.
Yeah,
you know, more than just like Starbucks doing like a diversity day of like, yeah, hey, people of color, tell us about how you feel.
Yeah,
and share that experience, yeah, with the other white employees.
Yeah, and like not investing in, like, you know, actual change, you, yeah, know, and, yeah, like long-term change. So I mean, yeah, I think I they didn't quite make it into the shout out segment because did something shady in the first place.
Because it wasn't a genuine investment, yeah, in the people of color community. Yeah. But, you know, they got shamed into it.
Yeah. Okay, so now we'll move on to our what's being slept on segment.
I strongly suggest that you wake the fuck up.
Now for our what's being slept on. So, as Ebony said, we're talking about Finding Neverland, the documentary that just came out. And so Ebony and I watched parts 1 and 2 of the documentary. And we're just kind of like going to give you a little background about it if you haven't watched it. There's no like spoiler here since this is a well-known thing.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Jackson went to court for this. And even if you grew up, you know, past the 80s and 90s, I'm sure you still have heard jokes, references, whatever.
That's so sad that they're jokes.
Yeah, to the sexual abuse. And, you know, coupled with the whole R. Kelly thing, I think that this has really gotten conversations going about whether we're treating Michael Jackson differently than we are R. Kelly. So We're going to give you guys like a little background on it and then just give you our genuine reactions as we watch the documentaries and like what that means for us.
Yeah, so the two-part documentary captures the experience of James Sufchuk and Wade Robson, two men who've accused Michael Jackson of sexually abusing them as children. James, Wade, and some of their family members were interviewed, and it also includes a decent amount of audio and video footage of Michael with the boys and several handwritten letters and faxes exchanged between them. They talk about their friendship with Michael and, well, I should say friendship in quotes. Yeah. So their quote-unquote friendship with Michael and their experience working with him during their childhood. So they had like cameos in some of the music videos. One of them, or was it both of them, were like dancers. Well, one of them was like a very serious dancer.
Yeah.
And
the other one was like an actor.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that his relationship with each of the boys lasted between several months to a few years. And so although the documentary was about them, there are also other boys that have accused Michael Jackson of the same kind of abuse.
Yeah, yeah.
So one main topic in the media surrounding this documentary, apart from, you know, its credibility, is whether it was appropriate to create it in the first place. And so a lot of people have said that, you know, well, one, that black celebrity men are kind of just being attacked, that it isn't right to have a documentary where the person isn't there to defend themselves, which I think is so interesting. So what do you think, Z? Do you think that it was appropriate for them to create the document given that Michael isn't here to defend himself?
Yeah, I mean, a part of me says, like, it's unfair to not get statements from mm-hmm. anyone from his estate or from his camp, or even from the people who said that they weren't abused, like Macaulay Culkin, and then there's another child who actually, I was reading, sent a letter to the documentary producers saying that he wanted them to remove his pictures and to remove his name, because he did not believe that he was abused by Michael Jackson. And
removed it from the documentary?
Yeah, it was like the Brett kid.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, his people sent a letter to the producer saying they didn't want those pictures of him to be used or for them to talk about him, because it suggested that he was like saying that he was abused by Michael Jackson, where he denies any such claim and in fact is hurt by this because he considers Michael Jackson to be one of his best friends.
Wow.
And then, so I think like that stuff like that kind of makes me feel like that isn't fair. But also I know that some victims only feel comfortable like years and years and years later. Mm-hmm. And so after Michael Jackson died, you know, and I, you know, in talking about how they shared their stories or finally admitted it, one guy didn't admit it till he went to therapy. The other guy, like someone just point blank asked him. And then as an adult, he was able to talk about it. And I know that this is like common with victims of sexual abuse, is sometimes they don't say it until decades after.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem too like out of place for me to think that it's not until this point that these men are able to talk about the abuse that happened. But I do think that it was unfair for them to still talk about some, because it's like you can't make someone a victim if they don't consider themselves one.
Yeah.
And for them to group, you know, Macaulay Culkin and then that other child who denies being abused as if he was a victim too, you know, even if you think he was and if you saw it, if that person's not saying it, I don't think it's your place to talk about that. So when I read that, I was like, that's kind of, it read me the wrong way that the producer didn't respect that of him.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think that this was an important documentary because, you know, when I was growing up, and I remember when Michael Jackson died, I cried because I was really sad because, mm-hmm. I loved his music. And then knowing, you know, watching the trials and about the TV and all the interviews was so different when I was a teenager than it is now. And now, you know, not only as a parent, but, you know, being the age that I am, I was able to understand a whole bunch more. Like, I remember back then I was like, it doesn't, you know, Michael Jackson just didn't have his childhood. So sleeping with 7-year-olds isn't that bad because he's just a kid. Yeah. But now it's like, no, like that's wrong. Like he didn't sleep with the sisters. Like he slept with the boys.
Yeah.
And so there's just so much more that I pick up on that I'm like, this is, you know, I believe the stories of these people. So I think that this documentary was important and appropriate, but I don't like that it was too one-sided. And even if Michael Jackson wasn't here to defend himself, there's ways that you can have people from his family or from, and even if they refuse, they could have put something that said, we reached out to Michael Jackson's family in regards to these allegations and they have refused or something. And so that part I felt wasn't appropriate.
I wonder if they could have gotten anyone that didn't think that Michael did it to participate in this documentary. Because I could imagine that it would, but like you said, like they could have indicated that they did reach out and that no one agreed.
Yeah.
But I heard also that this documentary was meant to, to expose the experiences of these boys and to allow their voices to be heard. Well, now they're adult men, but, you know, I think that it's a really hard decision to come to about, you know, the appropriateness of it, because like you're saying, if Michael Jackson is dead, which I mean Michael Jackson, so because Michael Jackson is dead, there would be no way to really get a truly equally balanced kind of documentary, because the boys themselves are, or the men themselves are included in this documentary. It isn't just their families kind of talking about their experience, and we wouldn't be able to achieve the same thing with Michael. So what were your overall takeaways?
I think that the level of detail that they provided, plus the actual, like from one of the cases, the jewelry that Michael got him, just how the details in it made me believe it so much more. And at parts, at certain times, I thought it was too much. I was like, this is so
did you have to
graphic.
Pause it?
Yeah, I did. I was like, this is so graphic. Yeah. Especially about, like, you know, they were very descriptive.
Yeah.
But then, and one of the things that they said that really got me was they were like, you know, people see me as an adult man, but this happened to me when I was a kid. So it's like, yes, you see an adult man talking about these things that make you uncomfortable, but if we were to picture a 7-year-old saying this, that would be like, you would definitely believe a 7-year-old, like, telling you, like, these things and stuff. And then I think that...
But how old were they when they were initially... Like, when they initially accused him? They were kids, right?
Yeah, they were kids.
And people
still
didn't believe them.
That's true. That's
like, Michael Jackson was untouchable. And low-key still is, because even though he's dead, people are still like, nah.
Yeah.
He couldn't have done that. He wouldn't have done that.
Yeah. I mean, even now, it's... we were talking about this before. It's, like, hard to believe. But there's too much evidence for you not to. Some people are saying, like... I wasn't abused by him. Like, I don't know what they're talking about.
You said you don't understand why.
Yeah, like, that confuses me. It's like, oh, so how does that fit into this? Plus, I'm not confused about the guy, one of the guys, like, at first being adamant and saying he was not abused.
Yeah.
Because both of these people sounded like, they, one of the guys even said, I was in love with Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And I believe it. I believe that they thought they were in a relationship with Michael Jackson, and they did not think it was, so he didn't think he was abused because he was in love with, he was doing things with the person that he loved. That made sense to me.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until later, because even with me, like, there are things that I learn about, you know, growing up that I was like, oh, that's being poor. I thought that was normal. And you don't, you know, it's not until you're older that you can compare things and you can be like, oh, that wasn't normal. So people who are like, oh, he, you know, in his testimony said Michael didn't do it, and now he's saying he did. Like, we can't believe him. It's like, no, like, that is so common. And he's explaining it. It makes perfect sense. And if he was like, oh, I hate Michael Jackson, like, he's a terrible person, he just says, I loved him.
Yeah.
I was jealous. I was hurt. I was confused when other boys came in the picture.
All the language, like, of someone who thinks
that. Yeah, they were. Yeah. It was very honest and real. And I was like,
and he gave him a ring.
Yeah, I believe. I totally believe it. And then looking at the videos and being like, Yeah, it is weird that he has a 9-year-old following him on tour. Like, that's weird.
Yeah. And, like, he asked the other kids, he asked the other kid's mom when the kid was 7 if he could come live with him. So,
that was weird.
So, I guess to give, if you're not going to watch this because it seems too intense, maybe we should give you a little bit more detail.
Yeah.
So, one of the kids that is, who is a man now and is recounting his experience, came from Australia.
Yeah.
So, his family, his old family lived in Australia, and he, I can't remember exactly how he came in touch with Michael.
It was through a competition, a dancing competition.
Through a dancing competition, he, Michael Jackson became aware of him, and they interacted once, kind of, you know, for a few days, and then they eventually, he and his family eventually went back to Australia, because obviously that's where they're from. At a later time, Michael, in a way, he sent for them, but it wasn't, he kind of made it clear to the mom that he wanted this kid to come live with him and to go on tour with him. And the mom initially refused. Over time, she decided to divorce the dad and move this little boy who Michael wanted and her other two children to the United States in hopes that her son, that Michael could help her son to ultimately, you know, become an entertainer. And then there was another kid. How did Michael become aware of the other kid?
He was friends with, he ended up doing a Pepsi commercial.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he was friends with someone who did commercials.
Yeah. And so then Michael became aware of this kid. This kid lived in the United States. What was odd about Michael's relationship with this kid and his family was that Michael Jackson, so this, like, you know, and this was in Michael's prime. Like, he's, well, I guess his whole life was kind of his prime. But he was in his 30s at this time. And he would go to these, like, these people, this is an average family.
Yeah.
An average middle class family. He would go to their suburb and stay at their house for nights at a time. And he would, you know, eat with them. He would stay in the little boy's room, sleep in the little boy's room, just spend the whole day playing with him. And this is a 30-year-old man. Yeah. So take it out of the context of it being Michael Jackson. This was a 35-year-old man going to the random suburb and hanging out with a little boy, a 7-year-old. Maybe he was either 7, 8, or 9. But hanging out with this little boy and having play dates, essentially. And the parents just thought this was okay. The parents just allowed this to happen for years. And, we're going to talk about the parents soon, but, you know, my overall kind of takeaway was that, like Zelma, I believe these guys. I didn't go into it believing them, and not even because I'm the biggest Michael Jackson fan. Like, I like his music, I recognize that he's talented, but I wasn't, you know, and I wasn't of the mind that, like, I thought he was, you know, guilty. I mean, of the mind that I thought he was completely innocent before watching this documentary. So it wasn't necessarily the documentary that changed my mind, but I think that it kind of solidified the opinion that I kind of sort of already had, which is that he was probably guilty, because who makes these random claims of people just out of nowhere?
Yeah.
So I don't think that, you know, like, there are a lot, I guess, particularly in the wake of what's going on with R. Kelly, one of the things that R. Kelly says is, like, oh, you know, people that his people, the people that have accused him of sexual abuse, you know, they just want fame.
Yeah.
And why do we pretend like, you know, being famous, quote unquote famous, for being a victim is not a thing? Like, we don't know these people's names. It's not like, oh, because they've accused Michael Jackson of this crime, I'm now gonna go and attend some lecture or some event that they hold. No, that, like, you get nothing from this. You gain nothing from this, aside from, I mean, a quick little documentary that I'm sure they aren't getting paid enough to retire on. I think that we assume that there are some benefits to this that I don't think actually exist.
Yeah.
And so I think that one thing that I pushed myself to do when I was watching this was to not look at him like Michael Jackson, this, like, you know, crazy celebrity, but as a regular man. So if there was a regular 35-year-old man that wanted to be best friends with a 7-year-old, would that not strike you as weird?
Yes. No, it is.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And I think even you know, and for a long time, my whole thing was, well, he was abused, you know, if not sexually, you know, there's the whole, like, he was exploited by his dad. Mm-hmm. And he, since he was a little boy, he was just, like, in the spotlight, working, making music, making, and he, you know, one of the things that it was highlighted in this documentary was how lonely Michael Jackson was, and, like, you know, how he had this house, but no one is in it, and how he would cry because he didn't want people to leave.
And they said that in the documentary, too.
Yeah, like, and so a part of me is like, you know, I used to think, well, he just, you know, he's stuck in, and one of the things people say about abuse is you're stuck in whatever age you were abused on. Like, you don't grow emotionally after that. That's where you stop growing. So if you were abused at, like, 7, you will forever be this emotion, your emotional intelligence will be that of a 7-year-old. And so I was thinking, like, well, he was abused as a child. He's forever a child. He just, like, isn't an older man's body. But that still doesn't
mean... But that's
mean,
not his psyche or his consciousness,
but that's,
right?
And that still doesn't mean that he can abuse other people. Like, just because you're abused doesn't give you the right to abuse other people, because there are other people who've been abused that don't abuse other people. So that was one of the things that changed for me with this documentary, is kind of changing my tune, so to say, into how I saw him as a victim. And I, this is the first time that I was like, all these steps he took, he was, you know, and for them saying, oh, there was boys every 12 months, there was a new boy, it's like, oh, he's methodical in, you know, and
it's the, like, dating.
And them, like, saying, like, you know, he would, first he did this, and then he, you know, it slowly went to this. It's like he was, you know, grooming these boys, preparing them for the abuse, and then making them believe that they would get, the boys would get in trouble if they found out, but also making them believe that they needed him, and that they were a partner, and that they were in a relationship, so that when these boys, it's like when the abuse was over, the boys, like, were sad. And they didn't see that as, oh, I'm free of Michael Jackson. They saw it as, on, why doesn't he want to do things with me anymore?
Because he was, like, he was their partner. Their, you know, like, they didn't see it as him raping them. You know, or molesting them. They saw it as, like you said earlier, you know, that this was a romantic relationship where sex was involved. You know, and so they, he gave one of the, he did, like, a wedding ceremony with one of the kids, gave the kid a ring that he still has. And the scene where he was showing the jewelry was so emotional. His hands were shaking and everything.
And, like, how the ring, like, was too small, so you could tell it was for a child.
Like, they, the, cause, and that, and I think that that's one of the things that the documentary does well, is that it, by showing the emotional connection that these kids had to Michael at the time, and the fact, and the way that they're talking about it, you can see that that emotion is still there. Like, even though they are saying, you know, they, that they were sexually abused, you can tell that they still have love for him. Like, they're talking, they talk about him in a loving way. They're not, they don't talk about him in a hateful way, or, like, you know, it, it sounds like it took a lot for them to even acknowledge this, or to call it abuse. You know, and a lot of that I think could maybe be attributed to the fact that he's dead. Like, maybe they didn't, maybe they wouldn't have, or it, I think it would be interesting to think about whether or not they would be accusing him if he were still alive and could potentially, you know, they could potentially engage in that relationship again. Because it sounds like till this day they are still they're still sad that that those relationships ended. They talk about him so lovingly, and just like, like they eventually broke up, kind of thing.
Like an ex-boyfriend, like a,
and not like an ex, like not like an ex-boyfriend where the relationship ended, you know, angrily, but like, you know, like, oh, it was a kind of a friendly, it came to a friendly end, and they're just reflecting genuinely about how they felt about him. And so I, Like I said earlier, like, I think he did it, and I felt like he did it before watching the documentary. But I think that celebrities like Michael Jackson, like Prince, like Beyonce, they do have that, they do, they are framed as kind of being superhuman, you know? And I think that that makes people incapable of, you know, thinking that they could be guilty of anything. And it just, it's really disturbing, and it should make you uncomfortable that when we think about Michael Jackson, when we think about priests, you know, we are so unwilling to acknowledge that they could be guilty of anything, that we would allow them to continue to harm people. Now, Michael can't do that, but, you know, the way that we understand abuse and the way that we understand victimhood and how we see these people as larger than life and being innocent until proven guilty, and even when they are proven guilty, we are unwilling to believe it. I think that the danger, it's ridiculous how dangerous our culture is. And, like, you know, it's like we just look the other way for certain people.
Yeah, and I think their genders played and their race played a huge part. So I think, you know, when people hear about R. Kelly peeing on 14-year-old girls or whatever, the people make jokes about that.
Yeah.
But with people hearing about a 7-year-old boy, like, getting oral sex by Michael Jackson, people are uncomfortable by it. And so it's like people were more uncomfortable about this same gender abuse than they were about the abuse between R. Kelly and these women. Mm. And then, you know, I've heard people mention about, like, oh, well, why is it just these white boys that are talking about Michael Jackson? Where are all the other, you know, the black boys, the other people of color talking? Yeah. Why is it only that it's these two white guys talking, these two white families talking about this black pop star? So I think, like, that race also, the different race also plays into people not wanting it to be true. The people who are, like, adamant Michael Jackson proponents. So I just thought it was, in comparing the reception of the Michael Jackson documentary to the R. Kelly documentary, it was just, you know, they were both abused, and you would think that people would more likely believe these, you know, kids. Or, you know, although they're adults now, but they're kids, and they're younger than the girls that R. Kelly, you know, abused. But it still, like, takes so much more for us to believe this from Michael Jackson than it would be from R. Kelly.
Yeah, and I want to say, you know, one thing that I thought was that maybe black people would have believed it had the boys been black. But, I mean, they didn't believe R. Kelly's victims. And so, I don't know. I think that when it comes to abusers who are black, it is difficult for black people to denigrate them or to, you know, think that they could actually have done something wrong. Because we also don't really think about child abuse and child, like, sexual abuse as being kind of a stereotypical black crime. And so I think that maybe because of that, people are dismissive of it. I don't know. There are so many different ways that you could, so many different things that you could use to, or explanations that you could use to rationalize it. But ultimately, I think that what it boils down to is that when we hold these people to such high esteem and we see them as being kind of superior to us, it blinds us to the fact that they could actually be guilty. It blinds us to the evidence. It's like the evidence is there and we are still denying it. And we come up with so many excuses for them. And I mean, I think that things that we wouldn't even dream of allowing a regular person to get away with stuff like this.
Yeah.
You know, like, you ask, and a lot of these people are parents.
Yeah.
And you ask them, like, I know black people that won't even let their kids spend the night at their family members' houses.
Yeah.
And you mean to tell me that if some 35-year-old man asked you to let your 7-year-old move in with him, you don't think that that's weird?
Yeah.
You wouldn't question, like, what his intentions or his motivations are? But because it's Michael Jackson and he did it to somebody else's kid, or, you know, he's being accused of doing it to somebody else's kid, there's just no way. You know, it's like, oh, he was just weird. No, it is weird in and of itself, yes, for a grown man to want to hang out with a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
But for him to have the desire to do it is weird. To have done it is suspect.
And so I think that one of the things that, you know, you and I were talking about is the role of the parents. And I feel like the documentary downplayed. I mean, towards the end, you know, they talked about the moms, and the moms were talking about how they felt and how horrible they felt once they realized that, the abuse was happening, and the grandma was saying, oh, you know, Michael Jackson destroyed our family. He did so much wrong. And it was like, Michael Jackson would not have done those things if the parents were not in a part a lot, making the access to these children that easy. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like a lot of responsibility has to be placed on the parents. And that's, yeah. You know, that's terrible to admit, but like, no one would have access to my child unless I give them permission. Mm-hmm. I would not allow my child, you know, I choose who he's around. I choose who takes care of him. I choose everything. And so if someone that you just met for 4 hours, and even the kids are like, I can't believe my mom just after meeting someone for 4 hours, let me sleep, you know, with him. And it was so, and it just kept getting worse. Like, okay, someone, a superstar invites you to his house. Okay. But you stay with your mom in a separate room. That's, you know, not that crazy. But then he wants you in his room. Yeah. Like, that's crazy. And then he wants you by himself. That's crazier. And then he wants you to go on tour with him. Okay, not so crazy because you're a dancer, but you're staying in a different room than your mom. And he's staying with you. And you're getting farther and farther away.
And she said that. Yeah. She said those things struck her as odd, but she didn't do anything about it.
And I was like, no, that's like, you don't want to believe it. It's not that, you know, don't play. She was kind of like, well, he deceived us. Like, he tricked us. And it's like, no, like, you chose not to. You thought this is so cool. Like, it doesn't fit with what I want. So I'm not going to let myself believe that there was abuse.
Yeah, you were so excited at the idea that someone so famous would want to hang out with a regular person like you, or would want to spend time with your regular family. And you were so blinded by that, that you let him abuse your son, even though all the evidence was there. And even though now, 20 years later, you're saying, oh yeah, you know, I guess it, you know, at the time it wasn't weird, but now reflecting back on it, it was weird. No, it was weird then. Yeah. And she said that her family members, that her parents were questioning her, like, you know, have you lost your mind? Like, are you? And she just ignored it. Yeah. She ignored it because she thought that he would make them famous.
Yeah,
and she was okay to overlook it because of that.
Yeah. And so I think that's a criticism I have of the documentary, is they didn't push the parents and the family enough to be like. And even the brothers and sisters who were like, well, I'm so mad at him. Like, he's such a, Michael Jackson's such a terrible person. To think about this, it's just kind of like, yes, but you did not, like, push more when you realize. I don't know. If, like, some 30-year-old, when I was growing up, took an interest in my brothers or my sister, I would be like, hey. Or if he was like, hey, your brother's going to sleep on my bed and you sleep here, I would tell my mom and be like, hey, so I didn't sleep in the same bed. Like, they slept together. Isn't that weird? So I don't know. I just think that a lot of part of me understands that it probably, in having to place the blame on him, it helps them feel a little better about, I can't believe that this happened for so long and that this happened to someone that I know who was so young. Yeah, so I think that one of the biggest criticism I have is I wish that the producers or the people would have pushed more on the family members they pushed so much about Michael Jackson that, you know, just to be fair and unbiased is to, you know, have the people and the, you know, the two guys kind of did talk about their frustration at their moms, but I felt like there could have been more pushback about the role that the parents and the family themselves played in giving them so much access and not questioning enough and just, you know, how things could have been different had someone intervened earlier. And I hate to blame people, and it's so much easier to say, well, you know, as the sister or as the mom, you should have just known. But it's just kind of like, yeah, you should have known that a 30-year-old guy who wants to, like, when your son tells you you're sleeping on the same bed as a 30-year-old, it doesn't matter if that's Michael Jackson. Like, that's weird.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't think there was sexual stuff happening, that's weird.
That's just, you just can't be that trusting.
Yeah.
And it's like, even now, you can tell by the way that they talk about it, the parents, that they were, you know, that they're wrestling with it. You know, it's not something that they're, like, they you could tell that they have blamed themselves a little bit over the years, and they tried to tone it down for the documentary because maybe they don't want to come across as like unfit. But I mean, you could tell by the way that they talk about it, like, yeah, I mean, I guess it should have, you know, it should have been weird, but it wasn't, or, you know, I should have questioned it, but I didn't.
Yeah.
But then they turn around and say, one mom said that she would, you know, he kept their room, the parents' rooms kept getting further and further away from Michael, and their son's room.
Yeah.
And that she would walk down the hallway and press her ear against the door to see what was going on, and that it just always sounded like they were just playing.
Yeah.
But whatever motivated her to go and press, check,
is an indication that she was distrustful.
That there was something about it that made her uncomfortable, because now she's trying to make it seem like, you know, it just looked like they were just friends, like they were just best friends, and it's like, no, you admit that something made you uncomfortable. You didn't feed that thing. You ignored it. You silenced it. But there was something.
Yeah. And so I just think ultimately it's the abuse is definitely, you know, all Michael Jackson's fault. But the parents shouldn't just, like, as a parent, you have to acknowledge the role that you played in allowing this man to have access to your child and so much access to your child. And even if he did trick and deceive you, I just, in hearing the parents, like, there's just so many signs that things were happening and that there was changes. And I think that, you know, that should have been discussed more in the documentary for me to make it feel a little less biased.
Yeah, maybe they could have just asked them. So if it wasn't Michael Jackson and it was just a regular 30-year-old man, would you have let the same thing happen? And no, you can't lie and say that you would.
Yeah, yeah.
So why do you think that it's difficult for folks to consider that he could have done it? You know, I guess there's the obvious, like, you know, he was a major celebrity and they don't want to, you know, quote unquote, put someone on the stand that isn't here to defend themselves. But in addition to that, like, why do you think that there's something else socially that...
I think... Well, part of it is, like they said, there are no stars like Michael Jackson. There are no big stars like Michael Jackson anymore. Like, he was such a big star that, and I think even the kids say, I might have only met him for 4 hours, but I knew him because I saw him on my TV. Like, he was just someone that
they worshipped him.
Yeah, he was just someone that you knew so much about that you felt that you knew him. So it's the same reason why I didn't want to believe it. It's like, how can this person that, like, I grew up with, you know, following, you know, from when he was with the Jackson 5 to all his song, to, you know, all his music videos and everything, and then, you know, like, it just didn't match. Like, how can this person do something so terrible? And I think, like, one of the worst things in our society is, you know, sexual child abuse. And so that's, like, the worst thing that someone can do. And I think, like, that didn't match with this image that we all had of Michael Jackson as such a great person, not only, like, as an entertainer, but, like, he also did, you know, like his dad, Michael Jackson's dad said, like, he gave money, he gave back to charity, he allowed all these kids to come to his ranch, which now looking back is, like, kind of twisted. But, you know, a part of you just, it's just kind of like, how can someone be so terrible? And so I think that it's easier for us not to want to believe it. Whereas for R. Kelly, it's like, oh, you know, a creepy man creeping on 15-year-old girls, I can believe that more than a 30-year-old guy wanting to have sex with a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
So I think that plays a role for it. And it's like, had it been like even a lesser celebrity, I think we would have believed it a little more than if it was like one of the greatest, biggest stars of our times.
Yeah, I agree. And I could totally see, you know, like, say Beyonce or something like that. Like, if she were accused of doing something shady, like, we wouldn't just believe it.
Yeah, no, definitely.
We'd deny it. Okay, well, that wraps up our...
Yeah, so definitely, you know, if this is something you have to watch in, like, segments, because it's a lot, and it should be, because it's two very difficult stories, and so, you know, I I was a really large, I was a huge Michael Jackson fan. Right now, I'm like literally, I believe these people and I'm saddened by it, and uncomfortable by everything. And I don't know what that means for, you know, whether I am ever going to listen to his music again or like not, you know, let, you know, the baby listen to Michael Jackson songs or whatever. It's just like, but, you know, one thing for sure is that I definitely believe that after watching this documentary, I do definitely think that Michael Jackson, you know, was a serial abuser of kids.
And yeah.
It's very sad. So definitely recommend that for anyone to watch. Only suggestion would be to watch in segments. So if you have any questions, any feedback, please feel free to email us at woke.ishpodcast@gmail.com. As always, follow us on Instagram at wokeishpodcast. Send us DMs, like our videos. We usually give you a clip from our segments every week about the videos that we're having. We are going to be back on regular schedule now after our spring break. So if you have any questions, and we're going to be trying new things, collaborating with other podcasters, having guests on our shows. So, you know, we hope you enjoy the changes in our structures. But once again, just thank you so much for listening. And until next time.
Bye.